LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Giles Slade, who joins us to discuss his book, The Big Disconnect: The Story of Technology and Loneliness. Why do millions upon millions of people in the modern world feel that isolation and loneliness are major sources of unhappiness? Tablets, smartphones, and social networks all promise better opportunities to connect and stay connected. Yet what they really do is replace face-to-face interactions, and they disguise our growing inability to trust others. Have we arrived at a new kind of consciousness in which electronic interfaces receive most of our attention, to the detriment of real interpersonal communications and empathy? The Big Disconnect offers a bracing look at a world where intimacy with machines is increasingly replacing intimacy with other human beings. Hello and welcome, Giles, and thank you so much for joining us again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
It's nice to be back.
Giles, today we're going to talk a little bit about a book that you wrote several years ago called The Big Disconnect, The Story of Technology and Loneliness, which is actually more relevant than ever. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to have an interest in this subject.
I grew up in Ottawa, Canada, which was a very small town. And I did my first degree in English literature and linguistics. I got very interested in cultural anthropology because Edward Sapir, I guess, was one of the centers that he studied in was Ottawa, and I became very interested in the work of Edward Sapir and a guy called Benjamin Lee Whorf. And then I went off to Los Angeles on a scholarship and started to study linguistics and rhetoric. I was very interested in becoming a writer and did a PhD in cultural history about the humor of the Renaissance, not the Renaissance, but rather the Restoration period. And after that, I returned to Canada. We had some children. I couldn't find an academic job in Canada, so I began traveling around teaching in different countries. And I think I've lived and taught in about six different countries. And finally, after 9/11, I decided I wasn't going to do that anymore, and I just sat down and started writing under my own name. For a long period of time, I've been writing action books, pulp boilers, for a business called Harlequin in Toronto. And really, that's, I guess, where I learned how to write. I stopped doing that when I went back to university to get my PhD. And I guess Made to Break was the first book published under my own name. And A Big Disconnect was the second book, although it was the third book I'd written. Well, I got back from the United Arab Emirates in 2001 after 9/11, and I was struck by the cultural difference, I guess, between North America and the Arab world, which the Arab world seemed much warmer and much more interpersonally sort of friendly than North America. And I wondered when the change had occurred, and started investigating what had happened to us when we lost our interest in other people. And I wrote the first book thinking that our relationship with things had influenced our relationship with people, and as things became more disposable, people became more disposable too. And the book that I really wanted to write at the time was more or less the story of loneliness, and that's what The Big Disconnect is about.
And this really has been the trend, I would say, of the 20th century and continuing now into the 21st. Technology taken by many people to be an unalloyed good, but this is something that is, in fact, you know, is, as you say, is not fostering connection, which is ironic because, you know, so much of this technology are supposed to be tools of connection, and yet we have people doing things like texting each other while they're in the same room, or families watching the same TV show, but in different rooms of the house, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's strange because, you know, as you say, it's supposed to be a tool of connection, and yet all connections using these tools are mediated by machines. So you're automatically at a distance as soon as you use them, just as we are, you know, by telephone. I mean, this wonderful telephone link that we have brings us a lot closer, you and I, but it's a very specific thing. It brings us closer because the voice is an instrument of closeness. You know, texting each other is not. And so you don't get any warmth at all from text.
Now, you mentioned being in the Middle East, and obviously that's quite a diverse region in terms of prosperity and, you know, adoption of technology. You've got some very wealthy parts there where presumably they're as far advanced in the adoption of modern technology, if not more so than even North America or Europe, for example. And you've got parts, we think of all the war-torn parts of the Middle East that are relatively poor. How did you find it in terms of, I mean, did you get around any other countries, or was it just the United Arab Emirates? And how did you find their level of a communications technology compared to the rest of the world?
In the Emirates, they have, you know, cutting-edge technology, the finest stuff available. But what I found, I guess, was that people are much more concerned with interpersonal relationships, and so, you know, the bargaining game that you go through when you purchase something, you know, sort of someone sets a price too high and you set a price too low and you sort of negotiate towards the middle, is really sort of a social interaction that builds a relationship that will occur the next day and the day after that. So all the time that you're interacting with people, you're establishing the social glue that creates community. Whereas in North America, you know, it's all, you know, would you like to supersize that next? You know, that kind of thing. The interactions are very superficial, ephemeral, fleeting, and non-repetitive.
Yeah, in my one visit to the States, I did experience the have a nice day culture, which is kind of strange, because when you tried to then have an off-the-cuff conversation with a stranger, you know, in, say, for example, in a retail environment, there was a very mixed response as to how open people were to that. So for some people, it was, you know, it was kind of a don't go into that area, please.
Yeah. If you, you know, I guess there's the large urban centers of America, and then there are the small, more rural centers. People are much more approachable in small rural centers than they are in large urban centers. And I guess the connection between the urban setting and loneliness and isolation and sort of the social competition that takes place on an economic basis is one of the threads I try to draw out in Big Disconnect. Really, this is an urban phenomena. You know, people started pouring into large cities, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s, late 19th century. And as they did, our tolerance, patience, you know, with other people became much shorter, and most of our relationships with them took on a kind of economic aspect that was unfamiliar beforehand.
Yeah, there's been some research, I can't call the figures to mind just offhand, but about optimum sizes of human communities. It's really, really quite small.
We're wired for about 150 people. Some people say 250 people. I think this is called Dunbar's number. And there's a number of books, I think, that are coming out in the United States now about these things. There's one called Village Life. But really, we're not equipped to deal with the numbers of people that we run into in huge urban centers. So, you know, if you stand on a street corner in New York at noon hour, you'll see, you know, 3,000, 5,000, 7,000 people just rushing past you. When really, you know, we're conditioned, our wiring works for the size of a Neolithic village, which is about 150 people. The maximum size of a Neolithic village was about 150 people.
Now, I'm really not trying to sound like a grumpy old man here, but I notice it particularly when I go to London. It's everywhere, really, and it's the phenomenon of people. Two things, really. One is everyone on public transport with their headphones on. Not everyone, but most people. And people walking down the street staring, well, actually everywhere, not just walking down the street. They can be in a coffee shop, they can be doing anything, sometimes even driving their cars, and they're staring at their phones, particularly the new interactive phones. I mean, I've seen people walk into each other. I've seen people walk into moving traffic while staring at phones. And presumably this is something that's, you know, part of your day-to-day life as well.
Very scary. Yeah, people rely on their devices more and more. With the music and sound, I guess the popularity of the iPod when it first came out in 2001, there's a good reason for that. Interpersonal reactions that we have with other people excite chemical changes in the brain and give us a very reassuring hormone called oxytocin that builds trust in communities. And music does this even if you're just listening to recorded music. So while you're walking across the urban grid feeling lonely and isolated, you can make yourself feel much better if you're listening to a tune. And I think the other thing is that because we've become much less accustomed to interacting with people on superficial levels, we have become much less accustomed to interacting with people on superficial levels. And so we no longer say things like, good day, how are you, you know, nice day, isn't it, you know, exchange sort of pleasantries in the street. And instead we look to hide ourselves from other people by, you know, delving into our devices or wearing sunglasses or looking away when they make eye contact with us, that kind of thing. And I think that's what's going on there, is sort of a double thing.
You also document how, as a result of this trend over decades, that basic social and interpersonal skills are breaking down. We've could say we have a generation that never really learned those in the way that previous generations did. And even language, in my experience, seems to be breaking down, particularly amongst younger people. You've got the phenomenon of text speak, which is becoming just speak, just the way that people communicate.
Yeah, I think there's been a general decline in civility because people, you know, are unaccustomed to building relationships with each other and don't see the relationships as lasting or something valuable. And I think, you know, a man several years ago documented the decline of social capital in the United States in a book called Bowling Alone. I think this is one of the major causes of the decline in social capital, is that we don't make time to take time with other people anymore. We don't count them as important to us and give them the consideration and courtesy, which is really time. You know, you are patient with someone, you take time with someone. You know, gradually the social glue that holds our society together is sort of melting away. And I think this is very true in London. There's a local group I've been in touch with who has a special day at the end of August when you're supposed to talk to your neighbor on the public transit or talk to someone in the street, actually start a conversation. And I think it's a brilliant movement, you know, but it should be worldwide. It shouldn't just be London.
Well, I came from a sort of semi-rural community, and the first time I ever went to London was, I remember it well, it was in 1988. I went to see a Pink Floyd concert. Traveled all the way there myself, and I've never worn a watch, so I remember getting there in the middle of the afternoon and I didn't know what time it was, and I was just stood on the sidewalk and there was a business type guy coming past, you know, with his pinstripe suit and his bowler hat.
Right.
So I stepped forward towards him to ask him the time, and he physically leapt away from me like I was going to attack him, you know, and that was 1988. Ironically, he had one of those you know, the Wall Street type big brick mobile phones. He was an early adopter of the technology.
You probably got someone who is less interpersonally inclined than many others might have been. But I remember the BBC last fall, they flew me down to San Francisco for an interview, and I think I was the only person in San Francisco who didn't have a cell phone, and it was the day after Columbus Day, and I was looking for City Lights books, and I knew if I walked north on Columbus, I'd eventually find her, at least I thought so, but it didn't seem to be in the place I was at. And so I stepped up to a man who was staring into his cell phone, and I said, you know, the City Lights bookstore around here. And he looked at me like I was insane, you know, and said, why don't you use your cell phone? And I said, well, you know, I've left it. And so he actually gave me directions, but I think I was the only person in San Francisco who didn't have one of these devices and wasn't using Google Maps to find out where they were, you know. And we become so reliant on these things that, you know, that asking a stranger for aid is really, really a very unusual thing.
Yeah, and of course, there's another sort of side to that, or this whole situation, rather, is that, you know, technology enables us to be uselessly distracted 24/7. Technology doesn't sleep, and it's actually begun to affect, you know, our relationship with the natural rhythms of night and day, and, you know, the seasons, etc.
I think more than that, you know, when we are distractible, when we are in our most superficial self, it's much easier to sell us things. We're much more competitive, much less reflective. You know, oh, I need one of those. I have to get one of those. And also when we're isolated from other people, you know, of course we don't share things. So, you know, I need my own car. I live alone. I need my own apartment. I need my own refrigerator. So, I guess one of the knock-on effects of technology is that it breaks us down into individual, markets that people who manufacture more technology can sell readily too. And this has been one of the trends. There's I guess if you follow the history of radio or the history of television, it's always started as a kind of group event, you know, people crowding around a radio to listen, you know, a very expensive radio to listen to an evening program, and then breaking up into other rooms to listen to the radio on their own, so that they can control the dial and find their own program, that kind of thing. And now, you know, I mean, Sherry Turkle published this book called Alone Together. You know, we're all sitting around the living room staring into our devices.
I've got a great interest in architecture, and therefore I tend to notice new building developments when they're going up, and then just the lack of any sort of real creativity in terms of design that goes into them. But the point is that by far the biggest trend of the last, I'd say, 50 to 20 years in terms of new housing developments has been the building of apartment blocks. The number of family homes being built is way off what it was, say, for example, in the 1980s.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, in these apartment blocks, you know, the majority of the apartments are becoming one bedrooms, you know, that affordable one bedrooms where people can, or studios where people can live alone, you know, and more people. According to an American sociologist, Eric Klinenberg, more and more people are living alone, you know, all their lives. So there's this long period of non-marriage, not having children, just being a kind of solitary person in the urban center.
Another side product of all this, you talked about, you know, breakdown of civility, is that this phenomenon of hostility online. People behaving, talking to each other in disrespectful, as I say, or even hostile tone that they would never do if they were speaking to someone face to face.
I used to write for the Huffington Post, and you know, you get this, there's this kind of chained dog effect where, you know, a dog on a porch barks at everyone who passes and sort of asserts his territoriality and in a way that he wouldn't do if he was off the leash and was able to confront them, you know? So, but yes, you know, people have become much less civil, and because, you know, they're often anonymous online, it's much less costly for them to be incivil. But you find it in all public interactions, you know? So my wife, who's a professor, finds the students much ruder and with a less firm sense of boundaries than they had maybe 20 years ago. And I think the security forces at all academic institutions, you know, are coming to deal with this. I mean, you know, there are a lot of shootings and stuff in North America, but it's not just shootings. It's, you know, people sort of making demands of their professors in a way that would never happen before, you know, and demanding explanations for, well, a grade on a term paper or something like that. But it's just, you know, a mark of a basic level of skill that you haven't achieved, and there's no argument about it. But they seem incensed and want to register their anger. It's a very unhappy time, I think.
Yeah, I've got a couple of close friends who are teachers, and they report teaching younger children, you know, sort of say between 6 and 12, those sorts of ages. And they report a marked decline in standards of behavior and language and even the ability of children to communicate with each other or with their teachers. And there was one interesting story I was told recently regarding mobile phones being used in class. And after several years of having a mobile phones are not to be switched on in class at any time, they've actually had to now almost do a 180. And they now have basically what is called mobile phone time, where the kids are allowed to use their mobile phones because they found that it was so traumatizing for them to have to come in for, say, a 30 to 40 minute class with no mobile phone. I mean, it seems absolutely absurd to me, but that's what they ended up doing in this bizarre compromise.
Yeah, and think of what it, I mean, what's behind all this? I mean, so our economy is much more economized. The kids' parents are, working night and day to pay for their small family dwelling. They don't see the kids that often. The kids are left on their own a lot. They play, you know, online games a lot, have much less interaction with people, and, are used to relating with their peers, who are probably pretty far flung, by phone, so it becomes very important to them. And the reassurance of a voice on the phone, not just text messaging, but the reassurance of a voice on the phone is something solid that they can hang on to in their world. So, you know, it becomes very, very important to them. But it's a major social change, and I think it reflects, you know, really badly on our state of isolation and our state of interpersonal disconnection.
Well, talking about the economy is a whole other conversation, but it is relevant to this that we have constructed an economy somehow where, the situation there might have been, for example, in North America in the 1950s or 60s, where you could have, I know this is a cliched family view, but, you know, father goes out to work one job, and in doing so, he can pay for his wife who's at home. She can look after the kids. The kids can go to college. They've got one or two cars. They can manage the household bills. They get to go on a couple of holidays. And that seems to have been replaced by a situation where apparently we're much more wealthy, but really in what terms? You've got people working multiple jobs, as you say, parents both out at work, struggling to pay the bills. And technology is like some kind of, substitute for this. And it seems that you raise the issue in your book of people trusting technology and devices sometimes more than they do other people as a result.
Yeah, there's been, a systematic erosion of trust following the Industrial Revolution, following urbanization. And so we're now at an era where trust is no longer an interpersonal thing based on presence and touch. Trust is a kind of abstract concept that you establish online so that you respect the brand of say Amazon enough to entrust your financial information to them and hope that you won't get hacked and that you'll get your goods in a timely manner. And it's a growing kind of impoverishment of what it is to be a human being. And so if you can afford a vacation and you go to, Bali or the Persian Gulf or, Africa or some other part of the world where they are not nearly as materially affluent as we are, you can see people who have very powerful interpersonal relationships, very satisfying interpersonal relationships, and are rich in a way that we're not rich. Of course, they all want to come here and have what we have. They don't understand what it is that they have. But we've economized and marketed the best things about being human out of being a human being in the Western world, and it's really depressing, frightening. Sorry, I keep ending on a low note.
No, don't worry about that. I mean, it is what it is. If we're going to I'd like to see things change and evolve, and I think they will. So don't worry about ending on low notes. But
I see a lot of people, starting small movements like the one in London about, turn around and actually talk to someone on the street. Or, there are some artists in Berkeley who make these sculptures out of wire and put them on the public transit to reflect the people who are looking into their devices around them. And the devices, the wire sculptures are sort of looking into their devices, and they're sitting next to people on the public transit looking into their devices, kind of self-reflective. You know, I see a lot of people who are aware of this problem. I hope something's going to happen.
Well, there's the rise of slow movements, isn't there? You know, slow money, slow food, which might not be directly related to this, but it's part of a reaction against certain aspects of this, I think.
Yeah, degrowth, and I think there's a widespread dissatisfaction, and if that can coalesce in some way, I think we'll see a fundamental change in the direction of our society. But as it stands right now, there are really powerful forces that are involved in selling us many things, including oil and cars.
Another curious twist to this is that as human beings, we sort of have an inbuilt aversion to the new in some way. I think for the longest part of our history, something new would be questioned as to its necessity. You know, it would only really be adopted if it was a very clear advantage, not just for the fact it's new. And yet this culture has grown up around now, this commercial culture where we're clamoring for the new, but perhaps not really knowing why. And we also have a culture of cannot wait now. I mean, if you think about the horrendous spectacle that is the Black Friday thing that goes on, I've seen TV clips of that. It's just strange that these two, you know, clamoring for the new, cannot get it quick enough, replacing things that don't need replacing with new things because they're new. That is actually not inherent to our nature at all.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. I mean, we adopt technology. Now, the technology is a bedrock to human culture, so technology is sort of a special case, and we adopt technology really quickly if we believe that it's useful to us, and this is something we've been doing for 2.6 million years, and we've changed ourselves through the adoption of technology. You know, our thumbs have grown out, and our brains have grown bigger, and we accumulate and store knowledge in a better way, so that we can do what's called human ratcheting. We can extend our technology in a way that no other primates can do it. But there's also, you know, this development that happened in the 20th century of marketing that can, you know, sell refrigerators to Eskimos, and we've developed ways of shaming and blaming people into buying things that they really don't need. And so, you know, there's genuine media excitement every year when Apple comes up with its new show and has a bendable phone or a smartwatch, when nobody's actually wearing watches anymore. You know, it's really an interesting phenomenon.
In terms of the economy, of course, we've seen this huge decline in physical products in terms of, for example, ebooks replacing physical books and MP3s and downloads replacing actual physical music products. Though I'm told that vinyl sales are up over the last few years. Right. And of course, there was a tremendous sense of community around bookshops and record shops, and it's been absolute carnage in that sector, you know, in the last 15 to 20 years.
Yeah, and, depressingly so. I mean, I always felt, a good bookshop like Foyles in London, was whenever I got to London, it was a bit like coming home. You know, I spend a day in Foyles and then I go off to my favorite Indian restaurant, Khan's, and just spend the evening there sort of stuffing myself with curry, you know. And they're falling apart more and more. It's next to impossible to find a music shop. I guess there's a great one in San Francisco called Amoeba, but it's very hard not to shop online. And of course, the online shopping experience, doesn't create any personal interaction at all. The movement from, physical cultural goods to digitized cultural goods is really negative, I think, because, we're very physical beings, and you no longer have an object that you own and, can sort of turn to. It offers you comfort, album art, on vinyl. But also, the rights can be managed, so you own it only for a certain period of time. And then your music company will decide that it's time to change the format, and it's you know, it's no longer vinyl or CD or MP3. It's now something else that, you know, you'll need to buy a new copy of. It's very cynical and it's very fast moving. And I guess my third book is about, called American Exodus, is about a social collapse that I believe will happen when climate change becomes so extreme in North America that communities can't support themselves anymore. And I'm thinking that this is the point when all these radical things that have happened with technology will change. Of course, if the power grid comes down, we can't support these technologies anymore. And then I think things will change radically. And I suppose that sounds sort of science fiction-y, but I think it's very close, actually.
No, I would just mention to listeners that we did an interview when American Exodus came out, and people can find that on the website, legalizefreedom.com. Just stick your name into the search and they'll find that. But that's actually a point I was going to come to later on, but to deal with it now, is that ultimately this is going away. And I do reflect on when I see, you know, everything being digitized. And for example, I think the trend towards cloud data storage is actually potentially quite dangerous, because a time will come, well, obviously there will be physical books and you know, other physical media around for a long time, and there'll be whatever happens to the future of society, there'll be this huge legacy of stuff that was created. But I worry about a time when someone will, in the future, you know, maybe 100, 200 years from now, will be faced with even with a CD or a, you know, a USB drive, and just thinking, what do I do with this? You know, that if the technology isn't there to access the information.
Yeah, I guess the Smithsonian has this neat program where they store, I think, two of each machines that record digital information in a new way. But I guess if you can't get to the Smithsonian, if you're living 500 years in the future and you can't get to the Smithsonian, you're out of luck. With each transition, stuff is lost. So, you know, the vinyl cylinders that recorded the original blues music of, American, I guess, folk traditions, and or the, you know, the piano rolls that that recorded, you know, jazz music. When it's all switched over to, you know, vinyl recording, then you lose a whole bunch of that stuff. And so a big concern for me is, how much are we losing? What are we losing? And, you know, why do we have to do it this way? Why isn't there an archive like the Seed Bank in Iceland that, you know, that stores this stuff for us?
You mentioned earlier about in the past, listening to music, for example, could be a group activity. The image of, again, back to the cliched images of the 1950s, a family all clustered around the radio set. This switch to solitary listening, as I say, particularly when people are out and about with their headphones on, it's led me to question, as you do in your book, about the degree people actually are listening to music now. The time was when you would say, for example, you'd get your vinyl LP back in the 60s or 70s, and you would sit down in front of the hi-fi and you'd put on side A, and the needle would go down in the groove that would play through, then you'd get up and turn it. It was a ceremonial aspect to it. And I'm not saying, of course, that no one really gets absorbed in music now. Clearly they do, but there seems to be a lot of very superficial consumption of music.
Yeah, I took my 10-year-old son last night to see a movie called St. Vincent while my wife was in her choir at our local church. And I guess the last scene of St. Vincent is Bill Murray singing a song from a Bob Dylan album, Blood on the Tracks, that I used to own when I was in undergrad in my 20s. And you know, it was the only album I had, and I play it over and over and over again. And I hadn't heard this for about 30 years, and suddenly I realized that I knew all the lyrics, you know, and while he was singing them, just as he did. So we were both sort of creatures of a different generation where lyrics were extremely important, and your relationship with the song and the singer was extremely important. And there was no sort of superficial consumption of Bob Dylan at all. Whereas, you know, now I noticed in the paper that Taylor Swift, who honestly I can't say I know what she sounds like, has the most successful album in the United States and has sold 22% more than any other album currently out. And I don't follow music in the way that I used to follow it. Maybe that's a thing of age, but I also have a very sophisticated radio device from Boys, and I get radio from around the world, and mostly I listen to, you know, the Cuban National Channel or something like that. I listen to international music, and when I'm just sort of better than that, I don't listen to Western pop anymore. It seems kind of vacuous and empty, and there's not much that I want to own anymore. There's an online service called Songza that I really like, that has sort of playlists of curated by experts of old songs in many different genres. And I find that's a great way to sort of familiarize myself with a lot of music that I don't know. But we have become much less music producers than music consumers. You know, my wife joins the choir. I tried to join the same choir, but they wouldn't have me because my voice is too loud and I'm always off key. I think in the past, you know, I think before recording technology became sophisticated, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, I think there was a lot more bad music out there, and people enjoyed making bad music together, and people made music together, joined choirs or sat around in the evenings around a piano with a guitar, and that's how we consumed music before music technologies. I think it's a shame that those days are gone.
You talked earlier about the phenomenon of people living alone increasingly, non-marriage. There's also the huge rise of online dating. That's one of the biggest trends, certainly in the last 10 to 15 years. And everything that can be put online gets put online. So in some ways it's inevitable, but it's a sad reflection, really, if you think about it. Not saying that, you know, happy stories can't come out of it. They do all the time, I'm sure. But, you know, it's a case of, well, what did we do before online dating? You know, how did the human species keep procreating?
I suppose we had to talk to people, but now it's so difficult to talk to people. And I guess, you know, maybe at your workplace, you don't want to make a selection, you know, for a date, because it could go wrong, and you'll end up, you know, with a hostile relationship in your workplace. So you want to look outside of that. So what do you do? Well, I think in the past, you'd go around the pub, or you'd join a football team, or, you know, a football fan club, or, you know, some kind of external organization. But these things are falling away. You know, people don't join churches anymore. People don't join choirs anymore. I have to say, I'm not a religious nut. I think that's the second time I mentioned churches. But when we became aware of how isolated we were becoming here in Vancouver, we joined the Unitarian Church, which is a very low-key sort of organization, and they have many social functions. But you have to do something, I think, to defeat the tendency towards isolation in your community. And I think people's lack of time makes them rely more and more on online dating services. I've never done it myself, of course, because I'm happily married. But it's now, I think, greater than 50% of all people who marry these days meet through an online dating service. It seems to work for them, but I wonder, you know, if they'll divorce online as well, or send each other text messages when their relationship ends. I think it's increasingly a sad statement, but the amount of time we have to devote to each other.
Are you aware of the phenomenon that is Second Life?
Yeah, I know about it. I don't participate in it.
Oh, no, I wouldn't expect you to, but that's, for me, that's really disturbing, because first of all, it's a misnomer. It should perhaps just be called, for those who use it, Life, or perhaps No Life.
I feel very sad for these people, but I don't know. Maybe it's no different from writing a novel. You know, you sort of construct this fantasy about your life that you engage in a very physical way. So maybe it's like writing novels for people who don't have the imagination to write novels. And so it's a kind of prosthetic device of the imagination. It doesn't appeal to me at all. But I have to say, you know, video games don't appeal to me at all. And my sons, I have three sons, look at me like I'm crazy because they love video games and think that I don't understand modern culture because I don't play them.
I remember in the relatively early days of video games in the 1980s being, you know, absolutely enraptured by these things. And then at some point, quite early on, just completely disengaged from it. And I think there was part of me, a nagging part of my consciousness, that was saying, you know, this is going to actually completely take over everything. And I, even now, I've got, you know, friends who are my age, and they spend a lot of time in the evenings with networked games, you know, playing with other people around the world. Particularly if they don't have fulfilling careers, it really does become, you know, like a highlight of their day, which is disturbing to me.
Yeah, I think, you know, any of these things, I think, you know, television does the same thing. I remember when I was in my 20s, marijuana did the same thing. You know, a little later on, drinking did the same thing. You know, it became something that I could have thrown my whole life into and then not had a life. You know, so you make a decision at some point that, hold on a second, you know, as entertaining and interesting as this is, it's not replacing the thing that I really want to do. And, you know, I think it's particularly dangerous now because we're reaching something called the robotic moment, where there will be either robots with human personalities or robots that we will not be able to tell the difference between human personalities and robots. And these things will be provided to us as, you know, as potential friends to, you know, ameliorate our lonely existence. I think that's a really sort of sad state of affairs that, you know, that we, because we don't have enough time for each other, we're really, really willing to settle for this other thing that's just kind of, it's like Cheese Whiz, you know, it's sort of not cheese, but, you know, an incredible petroleum product, you know.
Well, I think that this cult of technology that has thrown up the transhumanist movement, which is kind of, you know, where your comments are leaning towards, with people like Ray Kurzweil and David Levy. Right. I think that this is missing a great deal of the essence of what it is to be human. And I've made this point on here before. I don't think there's going to be any singularity. I don't think artificial intelligence is ever going to live up to the hopes of its advocates. I think it's all going to go the way of the dodo, really, along the lines of what we talked about earlier, you know, as the amount of energy available to us changes.
Yeah, you know, there's a great trend of technological utopianism that's how technology progresses. I mean, you know, we envision this bright future where our devices will take care of everything for us. And so far we've fallen completely short of that. Now, Ray Kurzweil, you know, a very brilliant man. And, you know, I think, you know, what he describes, being able to download once we understand it, the entire personality and intelligence of a human being into a machine may actually become a possibility, I don't know, the next 20 years, the next 30 years. But, you know, once that's done, I don't think there's any identification between the machine and the being that was downloaded from. I think that thing stops being a human being and operates under very different principles. You know, there's no longer the Maslowian hierarchy of human needs because, you know, basically you just need new batteries for it. So, you know, I'm very, very challenged by these concepts and very frightened by them as well. And also, you know, I wonder why in hell would we want to do that? You know, we're biological creatures. Why are we so unhappy with our biological nature and the biological world, which was working pretty well, up until about the 1940s or 50s, that we want to create this potentially dystopian future where there are many fewer creatures and a much more ugly planet in perpetuity, so that, you know, we can live forever and be potentially more unhappy than we've ever been before.
We could have another entirely separate conversation around that sort of fear of death phenomenon, you know, which is what's at the root of that, you know, a dissatisfaction with life as it is, a sort of bizarre disgust, you know, body horror, as David Cronenberg, your fellow Canadian, would have called it, and this, you know, unwillingness to accept our own mortality. That's really what's at the root of it.
Yeah, and what is that really? I mean, that's really, you know, that's really a horror of nature that you know is a very recent thing in human affairs, and that horror of nature has mixed into our technological culture and made us want to escape in these really odd ways, you know. You know, I think if you really understand your life and if you really understand the nature of life then your own death is not such a horrible result or outcome. It's certainly not a strange or unknown one. And, you know, it's something that's coming, like the change of the season. So, you know, perhaps this is a bit too Buddhist, but, I mean, you should accept it and you can plan for it or not plan for it. You know, but it's not something that should frighten the life out of you. And I think if it does frighten the life out of you, that's proof that, you know, you're potentially quite cut off from nature and potentially quite cut off from the things that you share with all biota. And of course, nobody wants to die, but it seems quite inevitable. And you know, an individual death, an individual human death, isn't really as big a tragedy as perhaps the extinction of our species would be. I mean, the species continues, but individual lives, you know, appear and disappear, sort of like leaves falling off a tree. And I don't think that should horrify anybody. If it horrifies you, you're really quite stuck in ego, and you know, the ego is terrified of being extinguished. But there are many more aspects to you know, your consciousness than ego, and you know, you grow up, you expand, you understand things better. You have your children, you know, you see the seasons come and go, and you've had your turn, and fair enough.
Of course, technology has been used to extend human life almost at any cost, you know, beyond the point that would make sense. Was that intervention not taking place? In some cases, this is a good thing, but it's not questioned very often. It's like, if we can keep that person alive in whatever shape that may be, then we will do it because we can.
Yeah, and there's a counter movement. I guess, Oregon has passed a law where it's, you know, I mean, it's so strange. There has to be a law now that enables you to end your own life, you know, in order to make it all tidy. Whereas this was just something that naturally happened once you became old and infirm, and you know, you just sort of go out. Perhaps not in Britain, but in my country, you can just go and sit outside in very cold weather and just sort of stop yourself. It's very, you know, user-friendly way to die, or you know, taking sleeping pills in the end of life or something like this. So there's a counter movement where, you know, the quality of life is really the most important thing. And if you you know, if your body is in decline and if you know, the medical profession can eke out a few more years for you at an enormous cost, you know, they'll do it. But many people, I think, are choosing to, you know, go as far as have, you know, do not resuscitate tattooed on their hearts or something like this, you know, so that they can die with some dignity.
Yeah, it is an increasing part of people's, you know, will making and stuff. They're telling their significant other, their family, anyone who matters really, that, you know, do not have me on one of those machines, you know, sort of in a coma or whatever. I mean, that I must look this up, but that is ex-Israeli Prime Minister. Wasn't he put on a life support? He was there for years. He might still be. I have no idea, but that is just grisly.
You know, it's not something you want to do. In particular, you know, I mean, who would like to die in a hospital? I'd rather go sit on a beach and wait, you know, wait to have someone bring me, you know, little drinks with umbrellas in them and just sort of wait to pass. I mean, it just seems we do strange things as human beings. You know, we sort of we localize death, and we are terrified of it. You know, in when you go buy your chicken in supermarkets, you know, it doesn't look like chicken. It's sort of wrapped in plastic and comes on this little pad that absorbs any blood, any trace of blood. But of course, if you come from part of the developing world, you know, they'll slaughter the goat in front of you and you know, bleed it into a bucket. It's we're divorced from our own nature and increasingly divorced from our own nature.
You mentioned supermarkets, and I don't know how much this is noticeable in North America, but there's a trend now towards unmanned checkouts. Basically, you know, you check out your own stuff using barcodes, and banks have done something similar. You go into the bank now, and there's the counters have gone. It's all self-service machines, and we even have the rise of online banking and even now online grocery shopping. And the ironic thing about online grocery shopping is it's actually costing the supermarkets more. Their profits are down because they've started to do a lot of the stuff that we used to do, i.e. drive to the supermarket, load stuff up, and then drive it home. And now they're doing that and it's costing them. But the point here is that all of these add up to less human interaction as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to make a little film and put it on YouTube about how, you know, you can drive around the city and do all your shopping and all your banking and, you know, without having a single human interaction. I think that would be a very interesting film. Those automatic checkout machines perplex me because, you know, there's usually a bank of four of them. And so it eliminates the needs for cashiers, but each one of the machines, for each bank of four machines, there's one person standing there to service the machine when it goes wrong, and it seems to go wrong every time. So, you know, I keep asking these people, why is this automatic machine better than just you standing at one machine, you know, servicing people completely? I don't think they've got them down yet. But I'm sure that will be happening. And you don't even have to pay with cash anymore. You can just sort of swipe your cell phone across it and head for the door. It doesn't seem very cost effective, and it seems to facilitate theft. I don't know, but maybe I'm not an expert.
Well, it's our tendency to respond to every issue with technology, and particularly when the issue itself is stemming from some issue with technology. So it's complexity upon complexity, and
right.
That seems to be what, as a technological society, we know how to do. But not only is increasing complexity not necessarily good for our own lives, but actually in terms of solutions, we're quite often just adding another problem, which is will emerge at some point down the line, and somebody will bring forward a techno fix for it.
Yeah, and that's why social collapse is perhaps imminent, because where social collapse comes from, at least historically, is a society becomes so complex that it can't sustain itself anymore, and then it breaks up into, you know, the Roman Empire breaks up into independent European states, or you know, the Soviet Union breaks up into independent little Baluchistans, or, you know, Latvias or Estonias. We're at a point where our global culture, I don't think, can sustain itself. Even though we have very powerful machines that, you know, that tell us that, you know, there's Coca-Cola missing off the shelf in New Jersey, and someone in Mumbai should order more Coca-Cola. I think. As human beings, we resent these levels of complexity, and we resent the level of documentation and surveillance that is taking place, under the name of, modern corporate life. And so, when things begin to crumble, I think a lot of people will collaborate in kicking it down the stairs.
Yeah, I think this is already happening. I mean, perhaps this would be a point just to close on, that this process is already underway. The march of technology, of course, continues. There's a new iPhone, however often it is, and that's, you know, that will continue for a while as well. But both in terms of physical and technological limits and in people's reaction against some of these trends, this process is underway, and it's only going to increase, I think, going forward in the next few years.
Yeah, I think, progressive destabilization of the world is a sign of what's to come. You know, things in Ukraine, Hong Kong, the Arab world. There's no longer a superpower to appeal to and sort of regulate how bad things can get. And as I think, independent states and organizations discover how newly independent they are, we'll see a lot more regionalization and factionalism and a lot less collective organization, and gradually things will spin down, which seems like a tragedy in terms of civilization, but of course it's spinning down before it starts to build up again.
So basically we'll leave folks with a message of, like, put down your phone, switch off the TV, go and do something better instead. If you're a guy playing a computer game, switch it off and go and have a drink with a girl.
You know, certainly much more rewarding than, you know, texting someone about what you're bringing home for dinner. I'm always at a loss to understand what it is that people are talking about when they're texting to someone on while walking down the street or while riding on public transit. I wonder Are there 9 basic topics? You know, what are they? What is so all-fired important that you can't wait until you get to work and fire one off?
Yeah, exactly. Giles, today we've been talking about your book. Say, it came out a few years ago, but it's extremely relevant. It's called The Big Disconnect, The Story of Technology and Loneliness. That's available everywhere, as indeed are your other books. Tell folks about your website and, I don't know, anything else you'd like to share, maybe what you're working on in the future.
I'm thinking, I live in a place called Richmond, Ontario, Canada, and a few years back there was a man called Robert Zakansky who was killed at our airport by 4 RCMP officers. This was 7 years ago, who are now being tried for perjury. And I'm thinking about writing a book about this, but it's dark and depressing material, and so I'm wrestling with it. It seems that our social disconnection has, at least in Canada, empowered our federal police force and become a real sort of dangerous force that actually threatens Canadian democracy and Canadian individual liberties. And I think someone needs to look desperately at why this man, first of all, could be killed, should be killed at our airport, and secondly, why nothing was done about it, and no one has been charged. There really has been no justice, and how endemic this is, not only in our country, but across the world. Are we becoming more more regulated by police? Are police less immune, more immune to public scrutiny? Is Ferguson the rule for the 21st century? And as much as I think that that's a book that needs to be written, whenever I think about writing it, my skin crawls.
Well, perhaps that's the reason why you should forge ahead with it. And of course, if people stick your name into Google, they'll pull up your website. I shouldn't say Google, really, should I? I should say one of the other freedom-loving search engines. Well, Giles, once again, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. It was very nice of you to have me back.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com. Where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were £7, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.